Thanks for coming to our monthly speaker series. Tonight we have Dr. Dennis Marshall, professor of theology from Aquinas College, where I went to school. Of all the classes I took at Aquinas, his were by far the most difficult, and but the ones that I learned the most from, the ones I remember the best. I took four classes with him. I made the mistake at one point of asking for extra credit, and I've not only didn't get it, but have not heard the end of it since. So that was a one-time mistake, but he's great. This is going to be a really good talk, so I'm glad you're here. So welcome, Dr. Dennis Marshall.
Thanks, Paul. Can I get away with just talking like this without holding this up like this? Oh, yeah, I forgot. This is going to go in the secret archives of the Vatican, right? Paul invited me to give a talk a few months ago. Little did I know that I would be giving a talk on marriage and the family on the Feast of St. Joseph, which is quite appropriate. But when in his invitation, he told me that he wanted me to give a talk that was much like one that I gave about 2 years ago at Sacred Heart Parish to the Authenticum Lecture Series. This was in January, even before the Epiphany, so still within the Christmas season, and the title of the talk was this, Unnatural Unions and the Collapse of Society. And I'm thinking to myself, just to hear a title like that is to have gloom and doom that ought not to be during the Christmas season. So Paul says, kind of tone that down, will you? And so I'm going to try to be a little bit less apocalyptic tonight, but I do want to give some reflections. I don't have much. Like I was telling Paul, I said, I've got all my points in my head. He says, we'll get through the first two and never hear the rest of them. And I said, that'll be sufficient. But I did bring a couple of sheets of paper that I want to draw quotes from. And I brought Humanae Vitae, that most notorious document from 1968 that speaks very powerfully to the moment that we find ourselves in today. And so since you've all had supper and you don't have coffee in your hands, and there's a possibility that if you're long in the tooth like I am, you're going to fall asleep within 15 minutes, I'm going to tell you the conclusion of my talk. Marriage is in a crisis today in the sense that human beings think that they have acquired the power to be able to define for themselves what that means. The Catholic Church stands in testimony to the truth of the gospel, and so consequently is going to be seen as an enemy of humanity because it promotes what God intends. It's going to be seen as intolerant. It's going to be seen as insensitive and judgmental. And consequently, it is going to draw upon us who testify to the truth of the family as revealed by Christ and scriptures, then we're going to be persecuted for that. I find that to be the case when I teach my marriage class at Aquinas College. I found that to be the case since I've been teaching marriage for the last 20 years, since I've been an adjunct professor in various undergraduate schools down to this point. It's also disturbing to note that many Catholics today share the sexual attitudes of the common culture, and they themselves are beginning to lose the sense and the meaning of marriage. And if we don't preserve that, if we don't promote the dignity of marriage, then that is going to afflict our own particular parishes and our own particular spiritual life to such a degree that we ourselves are going to fall and fall seriously. You already see examples of this over the course of the last 50 years in which you have increased divorce rates. Catholics have a tendency to have as high of divorce rates as those within the broader culture. You have the collapse of the family. You have the redefinition of marriage along lines that essentially says we can define marriage according to our own desires and our own preferences. And yet this is precisely what Christ calls us away from. It's precisely the type of conflicts that he entered into in the Gospels, which I am going to get to. And so it's precisely these types of things that I want to speak about over the course of the next 45 minutes or so. Keep me on time, okay? Now, the first thing that I want to draw your attention to is this, is that we see today society trying to redefine marriage according to a variety of relationships that are determined by the preferences or the desires of the ones who are seeking those relationships. So-called same-sex marriage, for example, is one such marriage arrangement that is being promoted as being legitimate, authentically human. And if we deny people the right to enter into homosexual marriage, then we are going to be denying them fundamental human rights that cannot be violated according to our Constitution, or at least even according to some people's idea of what human dignity is. Now, I'm going to deal with a little bit more with that later. But we've got other things, too. Not only do we have so-called same-sex marriage, but we have something called self-marriage. How many of you have ever heard same-self marriage? How many of you have ever heard of this? Oh, you don't read the things that I read, so I'm going to give you a couple of examples. And this is something that I heard of just a few months ago from one of my students. I hear all kinds of interesting things about the culture from my students who are embedded within it in a much deeper way than I am. But this particular quoted passage is from a website called selfmarriageceremonies.com. You can Google it yourself. You can find it. You can read all about it. You can, in fact, there are millions of hits that if you have all the time in the world, you will be able to hunt them down. But here is a quote. Self-marriage is a profound rite of passage into wholeness, trust, self-responsibility, self-liberation, and love sourced from within. It is a ritual of transformation, of proclaiming what is true in your heart and being celebrated as you make it known that you are ready to live to your full potential. It is the commitment to radically honor and express your gifts and the precious gifts of your life. It is the freedom to live authentically in alignment with your deepest values. It is the dedication to love, no matter what. How many are feeling the heart pitter-pat? You feel that? Okay. And then, of course, that's the end of that quote. I want you to keep this in mind. Notice the language. It's self, 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 self. It sounds like the very opening of one of Dickens' own novels, Martin Chuzzlewit. Those of you who are Dickens fans, the first lines in the opening book are self, self, self. Everybody's always concerned with self. Oh, gee, at marriageceremonies.com, selfmarriageceremonies.com, we are promoting self. Now, here's from another website. This is from a website called Barbara's Ceremonies. And you can even pay her money if you would like to set up your own ceremony to become married to yourself. Here's what she says. And this is what she says after talking about her previous relationship of 3 years. She found that when she entered into her next relationship, she didn't want to lose herself. She didn't want to give herself in the way that she gave herself to this to her previous lover, and so on and so forth. And so she came up with the idea of the self-marriage in order to, quote, "I love helping men and women who are currently flying solo," she says, "to create their own unique self-marriage ceremony in which they commit to loving and honoring themselves before any other person, with close friends and or family as witnesses who will support them in this commitment." Now, essentially what we have here is something that is similar to what Jesus encounters in Mark's and Matthew's gospel when he gets into discussions with the Pharisees over whether or not a man can divorce his wife for any reason whatsoever. That somehow human authority, that somehow human self-interest is the defining power of marriage. And we're going to see that Jesus has a different alternative to that. As a matter of fact, Christian discipleship has a completely different approach to marriage than we find in this this perverse self-marriage ceremony speak. And that is this, that a husband and wife are to pattern their life according to the pattern of Christ's own life. And in Christ's own life, he came to be served, or he came to serve, not to be served. And so consequently, the goal of the married couple in their love for one another is to lay down their life for the friend. But they can only do that if they love God above all things. It's only then that they can love their neighbor as themselves. And when we see such things, when people want to define marriage ceremonies as a self-marriage, we're seeing that whole reality of what Christ calls us to turned on its head, so much so that the only preoccupation of marriage is with the self, and so the self should be prior to anybody else. And in this particular attitude, in that particular ranking of values, no marriage is going to last. No relationship is going to endure in love, and certainly nobody's going to be able to self-love themselves for very long when they are not willing to give themselves as a gift to another person in the way that Christ calls us to in marriage. That leads me to a couple other observations that I want to draw your attention to. Because marriage itself is seen in today's world as being a product of our own wants and desires, and that we should be able to have any kind of relationship that we want based upon those desires, then we have an organization called beyondmarriage.org, which actually is a manifesto that demands that the state recognize any relationship that we care to enter into, any kind of family that we care to bond ourselves to or join ourselves to. And it doesn't matter if it's homosexual or heterosexual or bisexual, or, I mean, I could keep going with the sexuals, because they're not saying limit marriage to a man and a woman like those judgmental and intolerant Christians do, right? They're saying that whatever relationship we desire ought to be justified and certified by the state as legitimate. Now, what happens if I have a desire for my pets? I don't mean to get gross, right? But if marriage is determined by my desire, if relationships are determined by my desire, and because my desire by right is something that needs to be respected and also indulged in, then what happens if I don't have a desire for human beings, but I have a desire for animals and I want to enter into a loving relationship with a horse? What happens? Is there any way that we can stop people from entering into those kind of relationships when we say that marriage is simply based upon what we desire? Nobody wants to answer my question. You're just looking at me like I'm some kind of sicko. Mr. Bewer.
Well, you could make the argument for same species.
Well, yeah, you could, but people would make the argument for trans species. And that's what the creeper is. And if you think that that's out of the ordinary, that's something that might be so whacked out and out of the ordinary, I just want you to think about 30 years ago, those of you who are around 30 years ago, and ask yourself, did you ever think it was possible for same-sex marriage to even enter into the horizon and become a reality? Did any of you? No. Did you know that since 1987, people are arguing for pedophilia as an orientation in the same way that homosexuality is an orientation? And if that's successfully argued, you know what the outcome of that is going to be? Do you know what the outcome of that is going to be? in 30 or 40 years, then marriages to children are going to be okay. Just a few months ago in New York, an uncle was married to his niece. Legally, within the state, by a judge. So we've got that particular thing going, these particular types of dynamics that are going on here with regard to marriage around our culture. Now, that may not be something that you experience much in Fowler, because I hear good things about Fowler. It's a kind of like a traditional community, and it's got values that are not like, say, Grand Rapids, you know, the big town, we're the Gomorrah and Sodom there and so on and so forth, or even, you know, the larger cities. But nevertheless, we're exposed to these things through TV, so we're not completely insulated from it. By the TV we watch, by the programming we watch, by the things that we read on the net and so on and so forth, we're exposed to this. And I submit to you, it is a real spiritual illness, and one that is going to affect us seriously sooner or later. Now, I didn't draw your attention to, although I did mention bestiality, but I did want to talk to you about this for a moment. See this this particular thing I have in my hand. I ran across, because last year I found out that in February, I think it was February 2nd, there was this thing called International Bestiality Day. I never heard of this either, and so I went looking around to see looking around on the net to see what kind of justification I could find for it, and this is the manifesto of the particular group that advocates this International Bestiality Day, and what it wants to do is it wants to redefine the meaning of love altogether. Now, I'm not going to read to you the grosser parts. Aren't you happy about that? You could, like, arrest me for corrupting the youth, Paul. But I do want to illustrate this because I think it's important for us to understand what our Christian witness stands up against. We need to know what the roots are of the problems that we are confronting here, because if we don't know those things and we don't know the remedy to them, how are we going to effectively witness against them? That seems to me is the problem. But this, I wish I had a board, but this particular fella wants to redefine love because he thinks that all words are meaningless, and yet he's going to use words to indulge in his own meaningless. And he signs this particular manifesto with these letters, L-E-V-O, which of course is love with letters switched around, just so that you understand that. Now listen to this. Right. Love is a religious word, isn't it? Love is a religious word. Love is a medieval word. Isn't it a medieval word? Oh, sure it is. Yeah. It's even a Greek word. He could have said that too, you know. And then he goes on to say this. Love is an outdated word. Being a resident, thus a connoisseur of the postmodern era, I am well aware of how things are. It is commonly mentioned that only things we can rely on now is not science or religion, but the relationship shared with others. Guess what love is? A relationship shared with others. Well, that's not what love is. That's what he wants love to be, right? But so he goes on to say this. Every word in language is pointless and meaningless. Should I continue? I mean, really, should I continue? A word on its own is a simple collection of letters organized into a linear pattern. It's just letters. The true beauty of a word rests not in its letters, but in what it refers to, what it evokes in one's mind. Think of a word as clay. When clay is fresh, it can be molded and remolded many times. However, as the best kind of clay is always doused back into water to retain its malleability, some lumps remain dry and in the hands of a culture, and so becomes hardened into a single shape that cannot be challenged or changed, cracking before bending. Now, he starts to get crude after this point here. But why do I read you this particular point? Because love's real meaning is not found in what the word means. It's found in what I experience it, you see. So if I experience attraction to horses or men or multiple women or multiple men and women, then that's what really love is. But in the Christian context, what really love is this: to will the good of the other for his or her own sake. It's not a feeling. Love is not a feeling, although it's experienced oftentimes as a feeling. But to love is to choose somebody's good, to sacrifice your own good for the other good, to pattern yourself in a real way after Christ's own life in the way that he chooses our good for us through his death on the cross. Does this make sense? So what's happening here is we are redefining our culture. Our culture is redefining the meaning of the word, the meaning of the experience, in order to accommodate our weaknesses, and yes, I'm even going to say it, in order to accommodate our perversions. Now, this is the kind of world in which we live in. This is the kind of world that Christina's children and my grandchildren are going to grow up in. But the thing is that this world came about not yesterday, not within the last 20 years or so, but we can point back to its origins in the 1960s and the sexual revolution. So those of us here who are old enough to remember Woodstock, even though we might not have ever been there, we are the generation that is, in a real sense, responsible for the reinterpretation of love and marriage. And I want to tell you how that is, because it's not just me that's saying this, it's many others. Mary Eberstadt, for one, is a very good author, and she wrote a book called Adam and Eve After the Pill. How many of you have ever heard this? Huh? Adam and Eve After the Pill. You should read it if you have not. She makes an argument, and I think it's a profoundly correct argument, that the advent of the pill and the Catholic disregard of humanae vitae, which prohibited artificial contraception, is really in part responsible for the kind of topsy-turvydom that we experience in the world today with regard to our understanding of love and marriage. Why is that? Well, for nearly 2,000 years, the entire Christian tradition, including denominations of the Protestant Reform movement, all taught that the primary goal of marriage was procreation and union, right? The union of the spouses and the procreation of children. With the pill, with the advent of the pill in the late 50s and the beginning of the early 60s, there became, and its widespread use among Protestants who had been permitted by their own churches to use that beginning in the 1930s at the Lambeth Conference with the Anglicans, and slowly over time, most Protestant denominations accepted artificial contraception as something that could happen within the context of marriage, which by nature ought to be procreative and unitive, a separation occurs. The procreative is contracepted, or should I say, disconnected from the unitive aspect of marriage. So that sex between a husband and wife, because it has been separated from the procreative dimension, focuses more and more on the unitive dimension. Now that sounds nice, except that when you add that to the 1960s sexual revolution, that unitive dimension is pretty much transgressed and overrun by the idea that sex is nothing other than entertainment. See what I'm saying? And that children somehow get in the way of allowing us to enjoy ourselves, because the primary goal of sexual intimacy in the sexual revolution from the 60s onwards is to engage in sex without love in order to enjoy ourselves. Is everybody with me on this? Okay. Now, John Paul II, Benedict XVI, and Pope Francis I, they recognize this, and thank God John Paul II has given us his theology of the body in order to kind of counteract this nonsense. It's a real antidote to the problems that we face today. But in 1968, Pope Paul VI knew what was happening too. And he often gets excoriated because he was not with the times. He didn't bring the church up to date with regard to its sexual morality. He is the one to be blamed by, this is a close friend of mine who said to me just a few years ago, the church is 500 years behind in its sexual moral teaching. In other words, it needs to catch up so it can affirm homosexual marriage, maybe even pedophilia, maybe even bestiality, and maybe even whatever comes down the pike a little bit later on, polygamy. You see what I'm saying? Because once the church becomes up to date and up to speed in its sexual morality, then it is going to be relevant, it's going to be hip, and people are going to become Catholic. Right? It's not going to push people away. You see, it's going to be more attractive and so on and so forth. Well, this ignores certain evidence, fundamental evidence, sociological evidence that we've gathered over the decades. Here's the evidence, sociological. Families that artificially contracept are much more likely to experience higher divorce rates than those who use natural family planning as promoted by Paul VI, John Paul II, Pope Benedict XVI, the Catholic tradition. Because there are fewer divorce rates among those who do not artificially contracept, the families are much stronger within these populations than those who experience divorce and serial remarriage. Does everybody understand this? At one time in the 1970s, it was argued, because this is shortly after the no-fault divorce law comes out, that if we want to get a divorce, what's your name?
Judy.
Judy? If we want to get a divorce, Judy, then what's really important is that we're happy. And if we're happy, our children are happy. And if we're happy and our children are happy, then everybody's happy. What's your name?
Tina.
Aren't you happy, Tina? Okay. So... Now, in this particular regard, you have to understand that already present in that even kind of language is a restatement of marriage's reality that moves away from the love of the spouses, the mutual self-gift of the husband to the wife, their willingness to self-sacrifice for one another for the good of themselves and for the good of the family. Now it simply becomes, marriage simply becomes a matter of our of actualizing our self-growth. Our self-esteem. I need a self-marriage ceremony. But you understand what I'm saying here? It's a mockery of marriage. Now, the thing is that this idea that we can redefine marriage along those lines, right? That we can divorce in order to be happy, fundamentally ignores this one reality, that kids who experience divorce, whether they're young and don't really know what's going on, or whether they are adults and their parents get divorced later, those marriages or those divorces impact those children for the rest of their lives. And it impacts those children very much so for the rest of their lives, so much so that the children have a tendency to not want to marry, to not want to settle down, to not want to be hurt, to not want to fail in their own promises and so on and so forth, because they experienced the pain of that divorce from their own parents almost as a fatal blow to their own confidence and their own ability to be able to enter into a long-term relationship that will last until death. And we're really seeing that now, because in sociological statistics, people are not getting married. The millennials, I mean, Paul and Christina here are like oddballs, really, because almost like 35 to 40% of people of marriageable age in the millennial generation are not married. Not only are they not married, they're not interested in getting married. You can even read articles saying that people would rather have dogs as kid replacements than get married and enter into a relationship in order to bring children into the world. Why? Well, one reason is because of the pain of divorce that they've experienced. The other thing is that they don't see themselves as being able to invest themselves into another person, because when they would do that, they would lose themselves. That sounds familiar, doesn't it? We need Barbara ceremonies. Furthermore, because of no-fault divorce and because the experience of divorce of people, here's a bad statistic. Most divorces are asked for by women. And most divorces that are asked for over incidental, non-important things, right? Family courts, divorce law, and so on and so forth, is stacked in favor of the woman. So that if a man, and the young men see this, if the men dedicate their lives to working to support their family, put a roof over the head of their family, and so on and so forth, they can see from the experiences of their friends and from their parents and so on and so forth that that can be taken from them just like that. And guess what they don't want to do? They don't want to play, because they would find themselves too vulnerable. Now, all of this kind of stuff that is occurring is stuff. I shouldn't use that word. That's not a real college word, stuff, is it? Huh? All this kind of, all these kind of attitudes spring strongly into the cultural stream with the 1960s. Now, it would be nice to say that everything was hunky-dory before then, that everybody got along, and everybody loved one another, and everybody's family looked like Ward and June Cleaver and Wally and the Beef. But of course we know, realistically, that we don't do that. But let me just take a look at divorce laws and no-fault divorce. Prior to the advent of no-fault divorce laws in the mid-1960s, the social order was invested in making sure that families stayed together. Why? Because our culture understood that a healthy society depends upon a healthy family. The healthy family is the basic unit of society. If there is disorder in the family, there is going to be disorder in society. If there is order in the family, you are going to have a much more stable society. Since the 1960s, families have been falling apart. It began with the black community. Patrick Moynihan wrote a report back in the 60s pointing out that the black community, the black family, is falling apart. And of course, the white folks sit back and look, well, it's only going to happen to the black family, so it's not really our concern. Except that by the mid-70s, sociologists and other thinkers rightly began to understand that the problems that are going on in the black family are not simply limited to that particular race demographic, but they constitute what sociologists call a leading cultural indicator, which means the trends of the breaking a family and the things that cause the breaking apart of the family that is being experienced in a really profound way in the black family of the 1960s is sooner or later going to affect every family. And we see that. The only families that seem to be maintaining any kind of stability amidst the chaos of today are Asian families, but they're not safe. They're in America. And pretty soon, the same kind of attitudes that lead to the writing of LEVO and the beyondmarriage.org and so on and so forth are going to creep in and seep in through education, through television, through the websites that we Google, and so on and so forth. But back to the divorce. Prior to the 1960s, our society is invested in the stability of the family. So if Judy and I get married and then we run across a problem in which we want to get a divorce, it would take as much as 5 to 6 years to get that divorce. And it would cost an awful lot of money to do that. In fact, we were discouraged by that fact. not to get a divorce. And if we did go through the divorce, then if we did go through that process of 6 years, you know what the odds of our staying together were? Probably 95%. You know why? Because she really wanted to divorce me because I left my stinky socks on the bathroom sink one day. You know, that was the problem. It wasn't anything major. I wasn't drinking and, you know, womanizing or anything like that, being unfaithful. It's these little things, these little irritating things that have built up over time that finally become the straw that supposedly breaks the camel's back. Well, our court systems were wise in that. Because you know what? Things haven't changed in that regard. When I say that most divorces today are over incidental things, I mean like dirty socks laying on top of the bathroom sink. Things have not changed. What has changed? I can get divorced. What's your name?
Gabby.
Pardon me?
Gabby.
I can get divorced from you, Gabby, in 6 months, and it's not going to cost me anything. And it, just like that. When just previously, right, just a few years previously when we got married, right, I pledged my life until death parts us through good times and in bad and sickness and in health with dirty socks on the sink until death parts us, you see. But you know what? I don't really have to keep my word anymore. I don't have to keep my vow. And this is problematic for us. 1960s, we begin to understand that marriage is something that we can define for ourselves. 1968, this is from the most notorious. Could you hold that a minute? Thank you. Don't speak. I don't want you recorded. Vatican will know. Thank you. It's wonderful having such a lovely assistant. Okay. All right. In paragraph number 8 of Humanae Vitae, Paulus VI, he sees this coming down the pike. And this is what he says. He says, marriage is not then the effect of chance or the product of evolution of unconscious natural forces. It is not the construction of a social order. But rather, marriage is the wise institution of the Creator to realize in mankind his design of love. By means of the reciprocal personal gift of self, proper and exclusive to them, husband and wife tend towards a communion of their beings in view of mutual personal perfection. What is your what's your name again? You're Paul. What's your personal perfection? Yeah. Don't tell me it's your personal bliss. But as a Catholic, what's your personal perfection? Where's your personal perfection lie? You don't have a perfection? Don't make me come across that chair. Where's your perfection lie? Where's your personal perfection lie?
My love of God.
I'm sorry?
My love of God.
Exactly. And this is your lovely wife? It is your lovely wife. And she's to help you get there? And you're to help her get there?
Yeah.
And Gabby's your daughter? Oh, she's been a cross to bear, I'll bet. But it's precisely, that's the means. Your love for one another, you have personal perfections that deal with your human nature and deal with your divine vocation to the beatific vision. Being in a relationship in which you have a close abiding friendship is something that perfects us. This is you and your spouse. Being able to bring children into the world, which breaks the mutual admiration society of two. What's your name again?
Vicky.
Pardon me?
Vicky.
Between Paul and Vicky, when Gabby enters in the world, poof, their love is opened up so that it can include more within the circle of their loving. Oh, just kind of like God's own universal love, you see? And the thing is that you're relating to one another, you're loving one another, perfects you on the level of your humanity, but it also teaches you how to surrender yourself, to deny yourself, to place yourself at the service of another in the same way that Christ himself placed himself at our service. And this is how we follow the way of the cross in our marriage to achieve our ultimate perfection. Not by going to a self-marriage ceremony and pledging to be true to myself. That's not the path to happiness and perfection. That's the path to selfishness, alienation, isolation, and death. Because I can only be someone if I'm in relationship with someone. I can only know who I am when I'm in relationship with someone. I can only know who I truly am when I give myself to someone else and they enrich me with that gift by giving themselves back to me and making it possible for me to receive that. I can't simply enter into a marriage and think that I am just going to use this as my self-actualization project. Because then if I marry, let's say I marry Gabby and we get married and I'm using her as my self-actualization project, then I'm not treating her as a person or somebody who is beloved for me or somebody who is willing to be sacrificed for or somebody who is willing to be loved for her own sake. I'm only going to love her as long as it's good for me. And as soon as it's not good for me, see you later. Because now I just turn my attention to something else that is good for me, and then I pursue that. And when I get tired of that, and I pursue that. You see where I'm going here? In light of this, how much time have I got, Paul?
Yeah, like 10 more minutes.
Oh, 10 more minutes? Okay, good. So everybody, I haven't shocked anybody, even though I mentioned bestiality and so on and so forth. I want you to imagine this. We want to define marriage according to our own lights. So did the Pharisees. This is why they come to Jesus and they ask him if it is permissible to divorce one's wife for any reason. Moses said they could. You see. Well, it's not hard for us to imagine our own culture and society, us today approaching Jesus and asking, can we define marriage any way that we want it? And what is Jesus going to do? He's going to do the same thing that he did with the Pharisees. He's going to cut to the chase and he's going to move to what God intends in the original creation. What he intends for man and woman, what he intends for us in the original creation. And when he does that, I want you to notice something. He doesn't stop with Abraham and his marriage. Abraham was married to Sarah, and yet he was also sleeping at the same time with, what was that woman's name? Yes, Hagar. I'm glad you remembered that. Huh? Hagar, he was a polygamist. David was a polygamist. Solomon was a polygamist. All of these men are highly revered in the Jewish tradition, but not for the example of marriage. Because in polygamy, in adultery, in all these other kinds of activities, Jesus sees that disaster has occurred. And it's precisely these types of disasters that lead Moses to allow Jewish men to divorce their wives. Why? Because it's something that is God commanded? No, because Moses was making a pastoral decision to deal with the stubbornness of the Jewish heart. And so in an attempt to promote peace and well-being and so on and so forth, he allowed something that God himself, by his own testimony, hates. I hate divorce, says the Lord. So Jesus goes back, not to Moses, but to the creation stories in Genesis 1 and Genesis 2. And in pointing out that, he points out the true nature of marriage, of which God is the author. He says that men and women do not bind themselves together in this intimate union until death. It is God. Haven't you heard from the beginning that man and woman shall be united to one another and the two shall become one flesh? This is what Jesus says. And then, of course, he goes on to say this, what God has bound together, let no man put asunder. Not the authority of Moses, not the authority of the husband, not the authority of the wife, not the authority of the social order, not the authority of the state. Nobody has the authority to do that. Why? Because the union between the husband and wife is the closest and most intimate union possible between two human beings, and they become one flesh to such a degree that they essentially become the same identity. This is why Jesus in the gospel says, whoever divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery against her. Whoever divorces his wife or dismisses his wife dismisses himself. See what Jesus is trying to say here. So this union between the husband and wife, this one that makes it possible for us, I better do this, huh? This union between the husband and wife is so intimately related to, they're so intimately related that they become one in law, they become one in religion, they become one person. So if somebody messes with my wife and shows disrespect to my wife, they show disrespect to me. What's worse, if I try to make a joke about my wife which disrespects her, then I disrespect myself in the act of disrespecting my wife. That's an embarrassment, and it's certainly imprudent. Make sense? Okay. So, in this particular regard then, Jesus points back to, in order to live radically what God intends, then we bind ourselves by the means of a promise that lasts until death to another person. And we can do that precisely because God himself is faithful. How many of you, when was the last Catholic wedding you went to? How many of the people who were in the wedding party were like, they're crying. Even the guys are trying to go when they hear the vows. You know why they do that? Because there we come to celebrate not the love of the couple for one another first, but the love of God. And when we celebrate that love of God, which makes the love of the couple possible, we see in the bride and the groom the purity of that love. And we married veterans, we're sitting back there, and we know we were there once, but all of a sudden, you know, we're not looking so white, and we're not looking so tuxy. You know what I'm saying? And yet, nevertheless, the power of that testimony of the bride and groom, the power of the testimony of your own life through good times and bad and sickness and in health and so on and so forth, stands as a real witness to the fact that God is with us and God is the one who makes it possible for us to remain true to our beloved until death parts us. Without confidence in that, there's no way that we can do that. If we think that we can define marriage according to our own lights and live it according to our own definitions, then it's always going to fail and it's always going to look like a mess. But when we live according to what God intends, the way God calls us to, in which marriage is this path of personal perfection and, oh, by the way, holiness, because it is a way of the cross, then we achieve what Pope Paul VI recognized all along. We achieve in our lives. What do I want to say, Gabby? Actually, I want to say sanctity. And I'm going to say, hold this. I don't care if it gets recorded or not. Because look. Our world is in desperate need of the love of God and his testimony. Those of us who are faithful to our spouses and live radically that commitment that we made however many years ago, we live our life in such a way that we not only testify to our love for one another in our marriage, but we testify to the fact that God himself, who is love, has not abandoned the world in which we live. And when we live that love of God, through love of neighbor, then like a pebble that's dropped in a pond, our lives touch an ever-increasing segment of our world, from first and foremost our family, and then our friends, and then our coworkers. You see where this is going? And when we live in a manner that is consonant with what God intends, then we bring the gospel to the world. We make it possible for people to see that marriage itself is not something that we can define as we wish, because it always looks dirty and tainted when we do that. but rather that marriage is this beautiful thing in which God intends for us to sacrifice ourselves for one another, to bring children into the world, to sacrifice ourselves for them, and miraculously, not to lose ourselves, but to find ourselves, but to become truly who we're supposed to be. So we don't need same self marriage. So we don't need things like this nonsense of self-marriage. We don't need to co-opt ourselves by speaking the language of the culture and calling homosexual marriage marriage, because it's not. By definition, it's not. It's a distortion. It's a lie. It's a deception. In the same way that people living together, a man and a woman living together before they take vows, is a marriage. Homosexual marriage is no more a marriage than that kind of a marriage is. But if we don't stand up for what God intends in marriage and give a testimony of that in our own lives and a willingness to even enter into what a former student of mine would call an intellectual catfight, then pretty soon we're going to find ourselves pasted into a corner, painted into a corner, and we are going to be really unable to effectively, I think, counter the forces that seem to be dominating at the present moment. Because we've been silent for too long, we've been reticent for too long, we don't want to be perceived as being judgmental, intolerant, and so on and so forth. And yet, nevertheless, real love is this, that everybody in existence has their ultimate calling in a relationship with God. And sin is a violation of that relationship and prohibits people from meeting that perfection. And if we allow them to sin without drawing their attention to it, then guess who also is held in judgment? And that's a hard thing to take. But the fact of the matter is that if we're not salt and we're not leaven and we're not light in the world becomes evangelized by the Spirit through us in the way that we live our lives. And so we have to do that. Even in our small way. Excuse me. All right. I'm going to end up on that note. Okay. Thank you for your attentiveness. I appreciate it.